Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home, they never go home, they never go home, those boys.
That's... Yeah, they have asked for that, really.
You can laugh. It was the World Cup.
I'm a little bit of an idealist, but having said that, I want to be like me.
You don't know what you're talking about.
What did you want?
I managed to stay alive for 6 days.
I'd say it to your face, and I'll say it to you now.
I'm down to Anfield, and we'll see them, won't we?
What you doing down here, you shawnee man?
There's an unfortunate habit that's crept in among professional footballers in recent times where they make an honest mistake on the pitch, they miss a chance, they give away a goal, whatever, then immediately they take to social media to apologise to the fans. Like many of you listening, I feel this phenomenon is a scourge on the game, but for many of you holding up Bruno Fernandes as the latest example, with his comments after missing the penalty against Aston Villa, I'm going to defend him here, for on closer inspection, he didn't actually apologise. Yes! He did put out a 250-word statement on the matter, but not one of those words is sorry. So, Bruno, you're a lucky boy. I'm going to give you a pass. Hi, Ken. Hi, Murph.
Hey, Owen, how's it going?
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Monday's Second Cabins Podcast. Nobody is more frustrated and disappointed than me for missing the penalty and the consequent defeat, writes Bruno. I've always assumed my responsibilities and I've always embraced them under pressure in moments like this. Today I failed, but I took a step forward and faced the challenge with the same ambition and responsibility as when on the many other occasions the ball ended up in the net. Criticism and contrasting opinions are a big part of football. I've learned to live with it, even using them to drive me on. And I consider it all a very important part of my commitment to never stop trying to improve and to become the best player I can possibly be for me and the team. Today I once again took the responsibility given to me almost since I joined United, and I will take it again without any fear. Well, no, you won't, because Ronaldo will take it. I will take it again without any fear or dread whenever called upon. The most important thing for me is to win together, and I'll always do everything I can to help my teammates and the club be the best we can be. I'm a player who loses everything on the pitch with great desire and commitment. That's what I'll continue to do. Thank you for all your support after the final whistle. Hearing you chanting my name in the stadium was very emotional. I will come back stronger for me because these are standards I hold myself to, but most of all for my teammates and our fans who have always supported us. So yeah, to just over 250 words and not one of them was an apology. So, Bruno, you're all right.
what was the point of putting that out at all?
Yeah, I just don't get it. Like, you know, I think people understand that you will be disappointed when you miss a penalty in the 96th minute in an extremely embarrassing and hilarious to all non-fans of your club way.
Well, what is the point of putting that out at all? It could be a sentence used to describe literally any social media post any of us have ever put out. So let's be frank about that. I mean, if you're not going to talk about these dramatic moments as a sports person, then what would you prefer him just to wait till his summer holidays and put out some nice pics of his cruise on a yacht?
I suppose the key words are social media. He puts it out on his social channels probably because of what he's seen happening on those social channels. You can't just miss a penalty, go home to stew about it anymore. It's a world event now. It's an ongoing world event. And I mean, and because it's one of the funniest things I've ever seen happen in a football match.
The penalty miss.
The entire series of events surrounding it. The drama with Emiliano Martinez pointing at Ronaldo, saying, "You take it, yeah. You take it. What's going on? You take it. This guy's gonna miss. This guy's gonna miss." And I mean, that was a stroke of inspiration from Martinez. I'm sorry, but like, that was genius to do that. And he's standing there with this like ignorant, deadpan expression on his face, going, "Oh, you take it. Like, what's going on? No, you. Pointing. But, so that everybody in the stadium can see him pointing at Ronaldo, who seemed kind of like... To get,
I'm broadly
sort of
in agreement with you here, Emiliano. Like, to be honest, we may be on opposite sides, but I have to say, Emmy, that on this one we can find a lot of common ground.
But Ronaldo actually ended up having to sort of walk away, like it was getting too confusing for him to be, and sort of maybe a bit too awkward to be standing there going, I should be taking this. Bruno gets to take it, which I thought was, I was surprised by. I assumed that Ronaldo would be taking their penalties. I kind of assume he will now start taking them, on the basis that it's now my turn, Bruno.
Bruno does have a better record of taking penalties, but...
Well, how do you mean Bruno's got a better record?
Well, he's missed one penalty for Manchester United in 20-whatever penalties.
I think you'll find he's missed two penalties.
Two now, yeah. Two penalties up until then, before this decision was being made. And Ronaldo, I think, has missed four in a similar amount over the previous few years in football. And, we, of course, fresh in my mind is Gavin Bazunu swatting one aside a few weeks back. So, yeah, yeah. Bruno is an amazing penalty taker. So, he missed it. I think it's kind of a moot point at this stage because Ronaldo will be in now. This is all he needed.
No, I mean we're not finished talking about it. I mean, this was an unbelievable sequence of events. I mean, remember this is all happening also in injury time, and it's been the lead up to this is that a couple of minutes ago Villa have just taken the lead with a goal that Manchester United considered to be unfair. Ole Gunnar Solskjaer had been complaining during the week about the refereeing, that he's not getting penalties, and so on and so forth. He'd specifically mentioned Jurgen Klopp whinging about Manchester United's penalty records, and since then, basically, the refs have just been giving Klopp his way. Mm-hmm. There had been this, as far as United were concerned, injustice of a goal, and United have a case about that. There's the Aston Villa goal that went in, because brilliant header though it was, and you know, I don't think David De Gea is going to save this. The fact is that Ollie Watkins is standing there making physical contact with David De Gea. Like Solskjaer said, oh, he's pushing him. He wasn't really pushing him. However, he was. Like, actually what's happening is De Gea is pushing him away. But he is right there in front of De Gea. And how is that not therefore offside? I mean, you can say, well, he's not in the line of sight, which is the case, because like De Gea is sort of on the right hand side, but he's clearly interfering with the goalkeeper. If the goalkeeper's got his hands on him, or
we've had a few of these ones.
Push him out.
Yeah,
well, it's just game. after the game, the Brighton Leicester game last week, where Leicester had goals disallowed for like similar, but you know, it was Harvey Barnes who was like not in contact with the goalkeeper. You know what I mean? The ball kind of goes across again. It's like the goalkeeper can actually see it, but it's because Barnes is sort of there so close to him. And so that happened, and then the following week, United have a goal allowed against them in a similar. You know what's going on there? But then so okay, they come up the other end, ball into the box, and this time it hits Hazard, the goal scorer hits him on the hand. Everyone's appealing for a penalty. Are we going to get it? Are we going to get a penalty? Are you going to screw us again? Yes, we've got the penalty. And the whole place is celebrating. At least we're not going to lose, because you know, between Bruno and now, you say Bruno's got a better record than Ronaldo. Mm-hmm. Well, I put it to you, Owen, that in fact Ronaldo has got a better record than Bruno.
At taking penalties, I'm talking about.
Yeah. I mean, you're talking about like probably the amount of the percentage of penalties he's missed and all that kind of stuff.
Oh, well, that sounds like a pretty good place to start, surely.
Yeah, yeah. But I'm talking about just how many penalties has Bruno Fernandes scored?
It's 37 out of 42 or something, is it? Did I hear that?
No, he's scored 42. But Cristiano Ronaldo, how many has Ronaldo scored?
Oh, well, I remember this was a big plank of Gary Neville's pro-Ronaldo argument in the Messi first one. I was like, he scored, look at all these penalties he scored, as to show that Ronaldo. He has scored a great variety of goals. Look, he's got penalties and headers, unlike little Messi. It was up there like 60 or something?
139.
That was the worst guess I've ever had.
Penaldo has 139. Penandes has only 42. And you're telling me that you're going to win this penalty to Bruno Fernandes. I'm saying no. I'm saying if I've got Ronaldo in the team, like it was just so weird, the sight of Ronaldo standing outside the box watching someone take a penalty in normal play.
Yeah,
like, when's the last time this happened? Like, literally, who took the last penalty that Ronaldo was standing on the sideline for? Like, Dennis Irwin? I mean, you know, we're talking a long time ago. And obviously, he was first on the scene. Like, the very first thing Bruno Fernandes saw after skying that ball over the bar was Ronaldo just moving past him, like, you know, like a sprinter who's made a false start. Oh, he has to now come to a halt just in front of, and then was the first guy on the scene to offer a consoling word to Bruno as Emiliano Martinez jumped his feet and began groin thrusting at the Man United fans behind the goal. I mean, this was, I feel as though that display by Martinez is a legendary moment in football history that will be remembered in 20 or 30 years.
And his little dance afterwards.
I mean, come on. That's just, it had absolutely everything.
I will say, there's, you got to admire anyone who knows exactly the right thing to say at that exact moment. Like, yeah, there aren't a lot of weak points in Bruno Fernandes's. I mean, Bruno Fernandes standing over a penalty, he's usually feeling pretty confident. But at that exact moment, Martinez knew exactly what to say to make him, like, not just miss a penalty, but honestly, take a penalty.
So angry that he blasted the ball so far over the crossbar that, like, it's killing someone it's smashing into someone's face in the executive box layer. You know what I mean? Like, because he was angry, because he's like, okay, I'm going to absolutely blast this ball into the top of your net. And then I don't know what Bruno Fernandes was going to do. Maybe something like Emiliano Martinez's little dance, but it didn't work out that way, of course. He just put his finger right on that sore spot. And, you know, even Solskjaer afterwards was like, you know, tried to criticize him, but then, like, kind of ended up grudgingly admitting that it completely worked what he did. So it totally worked out for them there. So, you know, but you don't like to see it. You're like, well, I think we will be seeing it. I think we will be seeing it again. I mean, I don't know if maybe Cristiano is more impermeable than you know, is a goalkeeper really going to... Yeah, I suppose he might as well. He's probably going to score anyway, isn't he?
Bruno needs to get his head in the game quickly because Man United have a Champions League group stage to salvage on Wednesday night against Villarreal. There's also Juve-Chelsea this week, Liverpool away to Porto, and PSG-Man City's on as well. Our World Service members will be treated to plenty of Champions League coverage during the week. If you want to join them, have a look at secondcaptains.com where you can sign up in just a couple of minutes. Rory Smith and Dion Fanning are on the show today on the weekend's football after your report on Sportkin.
Yeah, so I mean that game was obviously the big upset of the weekend. Man United have lost 3 out of 4 now. I thought that Aston Villa played really well. When you look at what happened in the game, they really shut United down in a weird way. I mean, because in one sense they didn't. They had United had 28 shots, I think. 28 shots, but only 4 of these were on target. You know, most of them were blocked, and a lot of it had to do with the sort of wastefulness of Greenwood. You're kind of looking at Greenwood going, what's going on here? Why don't you ever pass? Have you been told specifically not to pass? Because it's the only way it makes sense what I'm seeing here. You know what I mean? Some of his decisions in front of goal. I mean, a player can get into a situation where he feels like he should have already scored and wants to make up for it with the next one. And it kind of became a little bit pathological with Greenwood there. But, you know, when you look at how Villa managed to manipulate what Man United were doing, who was the United player who always seemed to be on the ball? The answer is Aaron Wan-Bissaka.
I'm just, my confidence is rocked, so I'm not going to do it.
The answer is Aaron Wan-Bissaka. And that's just
God,
not
I really
a
thought you were gonna, I thought you were going to do the decent thing there, at least throw a name into the hat. That's really poor form by you, I have to say.
I'm licking my wounds. I'm going to put out an apology to the Second Captain's listeners. I'm actually composing it right now, so I might be a bit distracted.
Well, Aaron Wan-Bissaka is on the ball more than anybody else. Way more than anybody else in the Man United team. That's not that is not Ole Gunnar Solskjaer's plan. That is Dean Smith's plan. That's happened there. Although, you know, you're looking at it and you're kind of thinking, well, what went wrong for Man United? Okay, clearly, if they'd scored one or two of these 28 chances or half chances. None of them were really particularly good chances because the XG in the game was pretty level. When you take away United's penalty, which obviously they missed. And, you know, Villa had a fantastic chance with Target where he really should have scored, knocked the ball over the bar with like the whole goal to pretty much aim at. But McTominay in the game has 23 passes. You're sort of like, that's really not... No, he didn't play the whole game. He came off about 10 minutes ago. But that's just... For a central midfielder, playing for Manchester United at home, that's you know... I mean... What can you say about that? What I would suggest is that this was not a game to have McTominay playing with Fred in the middle. I mean, and the fact that Ole Gunnar Solskjaer thought that it was, I suppose, shows the respect that he was giving to Aston Villa, who came with a fairly disciplined defensive setup, but they've got Ings and Watkins who are just running, doing a lot of running, kind of in behind, and very, very mobile strikers. And he obviously was afraid of them. So he plays the McFred, double padlock midfield combination. I think this might have been a game to try our friend Paul Pogba in central midfield. And the fact that he's not willing to try Pogba in central midfield at home to Aston Villa makes you wonder if he really ever is going to... Because, you know, I say at home to Aston Villa, Villa is not one of the easiest games that you're going to be playing in the Premier League, definitely not. But, like, still, you know, you're playing at home to Villa. You've got to think this is a game that you should be controlling and, you know, back yourself to be able to win this game. But he went with a kind of a safety first option, maybe worried about the defeat, which ended up happening. The defeat ended up happening anyway. Pogba playing on the left as he you know got the four or five assists, whatever it was against Leeds, was not really influential in the game. You know, he's kind of wasted there. McTominay did absolutely nothing in the middle, and really. You know, this 28 shots conceals a kind of a dearth of creativity, which ultimately Villa punished, and were good value for the win.
Before you get too stuck into Man United here, Ken.
Well, I'm finished talking about Man United. I'm not going to sit here kicking Man United all day.
Good, because I've got an email from Jeff Deerking, who's emailing all the way from the United States of America. Congratulations, Jeff, on your Ryder Cup win. Well done, Jeff.
That's great to be able to say that.
It is great to be able to say that.
Jeff says he was interested in the email about Man United bias last week. So yeah, this was an anti-United bias in the media generally, I think, as opposed to specifically on this podcast. I really absorb your ideas about football, especially because I recognise that European football isn't in my bones the way it is for you guys. So I watch every minute United play with Ken's voice in the back of my head. I look for Cristiano to do no work anywhere but in the box. I look for Ole to have no tactics, in inverted commas, and to be out of his depth. And here's the thing, I don't see it. I don't see Cristiano Ronaldo not working. I see the team trying different things in different situations. Respectfully, I wonder how closely you're watching the games. I mean, there's a lot of football to watch as a football journalist, so how could you possibly watch it all? Maybe the claims of bias are people reacting to moments, and you sort of fill in the gaps then to construct a narrative. Bruno missed an important penalty this weekend. United played poorly, especially because their weak link in the team proved to be especially weak, that's in the centre of midfield, and Villa played well. As a United fan, my general feeling about the Ole era is best summed up like this. We wandered in the wilderness after Sir Alex left, in despair and confusion most of the time. We seem to have come back out of the wilderness, but the world we have re-emerged into is not the one we left. We're no longer in the deep dark woods, but now we're in a league that fully caught up to where we used to be. Sometimes I think the, in inverted commas again, bias against Man United is the standard against which they are judged. No club ever will dominate the Premier League like United did until Alex Ferguson left, and yet it seems like that's the level that many pundits seem to judge them against. It's great for the narrative because it guarantees a constant state of conflict. A win pushes the are they back narrative, and any other result allows for dancing on the grave of Man United dominance. Here's my current stance. Manchester United under Ole has played the best football it's played since Sir Alex. United is as back as it's probably possible to be. That one is in from, Jeff, of course. I'm sure we got Jeff's name right in the first place. So there you go, Ken.
Well, I mean, where to start? Like, just on the specifics about and I appreciate that I said just a minute ago I wasn't going to talk about Man United anymore. I mean, you know, fair enough. Like, they've lost another game, but it's not the end of the world. You know, we move on as a society. But on the point about Ronaldo not doing any work, I mean, where does this come from? I mean, just, just statistically, like he, when I say he doesn't do work, he doesn't do off the ball defensive work. He doesn't chase the ball when he's 36 years old, right? 36 year old guy who, like, if, when you're 36, you can't, it's difficult to run around like these. Okay, if you look at just the game yesterday, how many press, how many pressing actions is Ronaldo involved in the game? Five. I'm not sitting there with a pencil and paper writing down all the times I think Ronaldo's pressed. I'm using the stats on fbref.com, where I can see that in the 90 minutes he played, he's done five. He's pressed five times. If I compare him to Danny Ings, Danny Ings plays for Aston Villa, 77 minutes, presses 29 times. That's a player who's doing a lot of work, right? He's doing a lot of off-the-ball work. He's chasing down, he's closing down for the team. That's what I'm talking about. I'm not saying Danny Ings is better than Ronaldo. You'd always rather have Danny Ings in your team than Ronaldo. It depends, I suppose, on the kind of game. But, you know, Ings, Ollie Watkins, where's he? 17. He's pressing 17 times. Now, admittedly, in the game, Manchester United have the ball a bit more than Aston Villa, which means that there's more scope for the Villa players to actually press because it's the other team that has the ball. I mean, you don't press when you've got the ball, right? So, yeah, you'd expect the Villa players to have to press a bit more. But the difference there between 5 and 29 is stark, I think, with the two, you know, to compare the two strikers. So that's really what I'm talking about. You know, and if you look at Ronaldo, it's not just this game against Aston Villa. I mean, if you look at his performance, and again, you can use sites like this are very, very useful for that. You can see, like, he is in the first percentile for pressing. You know, for that, which is fine. It's just not his game. Like, his game is scoring goals. Like, he's focused. He's just ultra focused on that one aspect of the game. He's not really bothered with other things. Danny Ings is not in a position to just say, look, I am Danny Ings. I am all about scoring goals.
Not a bad goal scorer himself.
Yeah, I know. But he doesn't have like 800 goals or whatever to sort of point and say, look, just you guys run for it and then give it to me and I'll stick it in the net, right? Danny Ings is like an all-round contributor. You know, a lot of players have to be. Ronaldo's sort of evolved beyond that level. He doesn't have to do that anymore. Or at least he's not going to do it anymore. And if you want his elite goal scoring ability, you're going to have to put up with that and find a way to compensate for it. You know, that's so, which is how, you know, it's a weakness that he brings into your team while also obviously adding a lot of strengths. I mean, Ole not having tactics, I mean, Ole has tactics, but I would sort of question, you know, United after 3 years of this, like, where are they? Like, do you see a real clear identity coming out? You know, do you see like a style of play which is like, you know, beyond the kind of we stay solid and then, you know, we win it and we break with our with Mason and, you know, our sort of talented players on the break. I mean, Rashford is you know, has been a key player for them in that respect, and he's been missing this season, of course. But I just really don't see it. You know, I mean, I don't even see. Okay, the big game yesterday was Arsenal Tottenham. Now, this was an amazing occasion for Arsenal. This was finally, it was like the roof is coming off the Emirates in the way that it just so seldom has over the years. But finally, here we are. And it's like, wow, this feels good. This feels good. And Arteta leaping about on the sideline. You know, have you ever seen a manager play up to it so much? You know what I mean? Really performing
I enjoyed it.
Yeah.
He was like Shane. He was the Shane Lowry. Listen, I'll stop talking about the Ryder Cup. There's another podcast to do today on that.
But the Arsenal fans were loving it as well. But what you saw there was evidence of an actual Arteta ball identity coming out in some flashes here. You could see particularly those two goals, the two quick passing goals that Arsenal scored. This was like, okay, this is what I'm trying to do, and with Manchester United, I don't really see that. Like, I see like Bruno Fernandes make something happen, you know, like I don't really see sort of evidence of a consistent style coming out. And I think that after having been there for as long as he has been, he should be doing that. I mean, you can see it clearly with Chelsea under Tuchel. You could see it with Liverpool after a few weeks of Jurgen Klopp. You know, you could see the difference that he had made. You could see the difference that Guardiola made. So his first year at Man City wasn't great because what he's trying to do is quite complicated. But by the time they got to the second season of Guardiola, they were doing something that no Man City team had ever done before. This was the impact that he made. Now I'm comparing Solskjaer to the very best, but I'm comparing him to his competition. You know, okay, Antonio Conte, Chelsea. Antonio Conte had Chelsea playing Antonio Conte football after 6 weeks. You know what I mean? He started off. They lost 3-0 to Arsenal. Is that something that happened? I believe they lost to Arsenal. They suffered a bad early defeat, after which he said, okay, I'm dispensing with a lot of this stuff that's gone before. I'm going to change the system to 3-4-3, and this is what we're going to do. And drill them in the training ground. And within a couple of weeks, they were able to do this. I mean, just look at the difference between the Lampard Chelsea and the Tuchel Chelsea. This is what a top manager, I think, can do. And I just don't see that Ole Gunnar Solskjaer has done that. And you can say all this stuff about, well, he's put out the fires. That's
he's taken them. He's taken them out of the wilderness. Is the point that is being made by?
But like, Roger. I mean, there's still like, the wilderness. I mean, what? Like, where is he taking them to? Like, I mean, what's the? You know, look. Again,
we're going to talk to Rory, and we're going to talk to Dion a little bit about United and about Arsenal. You mentioned the Arsenal.
The tolerance for mediocrity is just, you know.
You mentioned the Arsenal Arteta ball. That's the subject of another email we got in from, where is it here? Andrew McGahan, who says maybe Arteta's finally found his best 11. They're starting to play how he envisions this team being able to play. Two blistering counter-attack goals, including a direct assist from Harry Kane for Saka's goal, has me very happy as an Arsenal fan this morning. Poor old Harry Kane. Even Oba and Saka paying homage to the greatest player to grace the Premier League with their knee slide, arms down celebration that he did so well versus Spurs over the years. I will even go as far as to say I'm cautiously optimistic that Champions League football will be back at the carpet next season, and we're about to see a run that will sicken the Arteta out Twitter fan base.
Sicken the Arteta out fan base. It's because that is ultimately what it's all about, really. that's what football has become.
Owning the Twitter fan bases.
Owning your hated enemies on Twitter. But that's what it's all about. And that no one can dispute that Arsenal had done. And, you know, this, like, Henri and Stan, you know, he was up there with the Spotify guy, Daniel Ek, you know. This was a real display, you know. I mean, I don't really know what was going on there. Like, I also don't understand the shirt Henri was wearing. Is that a shirt Arsenal used to wear? It looked like a sort of a jumble of retro ideas.
Real Anders Limpar vibe off the jersey. I would say it was the Anders Limpar era.
Well, do you think it actually was a former jersey?
Yeah, yeah.
It wasn't just a sort of an idea of an Arsenal jersey of the 90s.
No. You obviously don't follow Ian Wright on Instagram, who posts, like, deadly goals scored by Ian Wright from the 91-92 season on a fairly regular basis. 91-92, yeah. Maybe a little later than that. 92-93, maybe something like that. But, yeah, no, that's the era we're talking about here.
Well, you know, they totally destroyed Tottenham. Now, if you saw afterwards, Nuno Espirito Santo talked about Tottenham failing to execute the game plan. And it sounded to me as though he was kind of saying the players didn't do. It was one of those where the manager's sort of trying to have about ways where he's like pointing the finger at the players for not doing what he wants to do, but then saying, but of course I accept responsibility. Although in fairness, he also, when Sky asked him, so do you take full ownership of this? And he goes, it's ours. So it was kind of like collective ownership. But in the press conference, a lot of things went wrong, starting with decisions I made. Can you expand on that? It's not easy to expand. So I just ask for a bit of respect if I don't go too much into it. The game plan didn't work out. I'm very honest. If the game plan didn't work out the way you wanted it to work out, it's because you didn't decide it well. You said before the game, this is a special game, not like any other. Do you think the players realized that in the first half? Alistair, for such is the name of the journalist, I will not judge my players in front of you. I refuse to do that. Now, already Nuno's being quite forthcoming by the standards of Nuno. Although, in fairness, it's heating up. The kitchen is heating up, like 3-0 against Chelsea, 3-0 against West Ham, wasn't it? And now 3-0 against... No, sorry, 3-0 against Palace. Palace, Chelsea, and 3-1 then against Arsenal. So this is not good. And Arsenal are now ahead of Tottenham in the shortest possible time that they could have been ahead of them, since all the Tottenham fans were posting the screenshot showing Tottenham top of the league and Arsenal bottom after three matches. So now Arsenal have gone ahead of Tottenham. But what actually went wrong with Nuno's game plan? He told us with his substitutes. He didn't say what it was, but he made two subs at half time. Dele Alli came off and Tanganga came off. So Skip came on for Dele Alli to play basically deeper in midfield, and Emerson replaced Tanganga. The Alli change is the big one, because that's the tactical change. Nuno basically realized, okay, we need to have two midfielders, not just one. They started off with a front three, Kane, Son and Moura. And then they had Højbjerg in midfield, but ahead of Højbjerg, Dele Alli and Ndombele. And Ndombele, obviously a completely creative-minded midfielder. And Dele Alli is kind of a shadow striker, really. I mean, when he played well, it was as a kind of a second striker off Harry Kane. You know, this was like his best performances for Tottenham were that. And he's sort of playing in midfield. So the effect of this was essentially to leave Højbjerg completely isolated at the back of midfield. And when you add in the fact that Tottenham's fullbacks, Reguilón and Tanganga in the first half, were also pushing all the way forward, well, just look at what happened in Arsenal's goals. You know, Arsenal's goals, the first one was Ben White beat Harry Kane in the air. He heads it forward. The ball like drops to Xhaka, who just has to sort of nudge it on. And Odegaard is in completely behind the Tottenham midfield. Like, Alli is sort of beginning to chase back. Oh, and Ndombele, they're both caught like way ahead of the ball. And Odegaard is in. So Arsenal are in on the back four now. And they managed to score a goal out of it. Then there was the Ramsdale. Ramsdale passes to... It was nice to see Ramsdale not launching it. His launch percentage has halved since he's been playing for Arsenal. It's gone from 70 to 35. So that's, again, FP Ref. Haven't been counting it out with pencil and paper. So Ramsdale, anyway, now he's now playing short passes. He selects a somewhat dangerous short pass option to Xhaka at the corner of his penalty area. Xhaka is tackled by, I think, Højbjerg it is, but manages to sort of spin away. And then it goes to Smith Rowe, to Tierney on the left, and Tierney plays a really quick ball up to Aubameyang, who flicks it around the corner to Smith Rowe, who's continued his run. Who hasn't continued his run is Tanganga. And this, I think, is why Nuno takes Tanganga off, because he's like, well, what are you even in the team to do, really? Look at what happens to him on this goal. He's the player who's closest to Smith Rowe, as Smith Rowe plays the ball to Tierney, but he just then watches the ball go out to Tierney, who's on the touchline, and doesn't see Smith Rowe behind him taking off and making a big run down the left channel, because he can see Smith Rowe already sees what's going to happen. Tierney's going to pass this to Aubameyang, and I'm going to be the third man, and I'm going to have a load of space there because I've just run behind this guy, and he doesn't know where I am. And by the time Tanganga looks around, Smith Rowe is actually ahead of him. But I'd say what would disgusted Nuno even more is that the gap between them only gets bigger from that point. Like, Tanganga jogs. Smith Rowe accelerates away, and then I think it's Sanchez as the player has to come over. And Smith Rowe's last touch before he pulls it back is really good, because he actually takes it a little bit wider. And you're kind of like, is that a bad touch? It's a completely deliberate touch to drag Sanchez out and create space for Aubameyang. It was a brilliant piece of play by him, but he's allowed to look really good, especially by the fact that Tanganga doesn't. But Tanganga didn't even get back fast enough to create any problems for Aubameyang, like to put any pressure on Aubameyang when he's scoring the cutback. So that was pretty disgraceful by him. And then obviously the third goal is just another disgrace.
you're waiting a while before committing to this Arteta Champions League football. We'll be back at the
well, I thought Arteta set his team up a lot better than Nuno, and it was well set up to exploit. Like, they went straight for the spaces. I mean, maybe it was obvious to the players on the pitch where Tottenham's vulnerabilities were. Like the third goal, Kane lost it. And Kane just looks so... It's such a miserable game, you know? Being mocked by the crowd. He had a shot at one point from 35 yards, which is just embarrassingly bad. You know, just way over the bar. Just looked kind of slow. Looked anguished, you know? Like, oh God, unhappy me. Woe is me. You know, he lost against Ben White for the first goal. Third goal, he loses the ball. But when he loses the ball, there are six Tottenham players ahead of him. There are six Tottenham players ahead of him, both fullbacks. And this is Harry Kane. He's a centre forward, right? So, but they both fullbacks are ahead. Son and Moura are ahead, and Ali and Ndombele all ahead of the ball when Arsenal win it. And so Arsenal then come forward with the ball. And, you know, Kane is trying to chase back, but Højbjerg is just there. He's the kind of the guy minding the house. He's got the centre backs are there, but there's just these huge gaps on either side. And Arsenal just play it down, you know, a ball for Saka to chase. And Harry Kane, unlike Tanganga, at least he does manage to get back to put in a tackle on this guy, because he's got some sort of sense of responsibility for having lost the ball in this dangerous situation. But his full-blooded challenge does not manage to win the ball back. And instead, all he does is knocks it through for Saka to score the third goal. Now, I felt real sympathy for him at that moment, because it's terrible what's happening. Like, it's miserable what's happened to him. He should have had a penalty as well in the second half. This is another weird sort of aspect of it. Like, well, how can that not be a penalty? Like, Ben White kicked him as blatantly as you can. I mean, I think one of our emails today, Owen, suggests that it shouldn't be a penalty because basically you shouldn't get a penalty for a foul in that situation, which wasn't very dangerous.
Well, this is Joe Entwistle, who does note that Kenny's getting in touch despite you calling him an ominous sign for future civilization when he got it back to you on the Let It Flow stuff recently. But yeah, he's the one who's making that point about Harry Kane.
Yeah, like, essentially, look, you know,
Harry Kane is facing backwards on the edge of the area with three defenders around him. Ben White clearly made physical contact with him, but not that much, didn't put him in danger. And he didn't get the ball, but is that worthy of a penalty kick where there's a 70% chance of a goal?
I mean this kind of seems like he wants to shrink the penalty area to an even smaller, like, how small should we make the penalty area if this is deemed like just not enough of a goal scoring chance to merit a full penalty?
You have to be facing towards the goal.
There can only be one other player other than the goalkeeper between you and the goal, and you have to be facing the goal for it to be deemed a penalty.
Yeah, and realistically, you also have to be in between the width of the goalposts.
So, I mean, if it's on your weak foot, it can't be a penalty either.
But like, it is an idea for potential new rules. However, under the rules we have, this is a penalty, and like I mean, Arsenal probably should have had a penalty as well. I mean, I can't remember who the player was who was pushed by Sanchez. Sanchez was able to head the ball away at the near post, but
it was Gabriel, wasn't it? Yeah,
he pushed an Arsenal player to the ground. I mean, it was obviously a huge...
I despair for civilization if Joe Entwistle's. What did you say about him? It was an ominous sign for.
It's an ominous sign for future civilization. Yeah.
I can't remember why I described.
You were in your
that.
Let It flow state, Ken.
Yeah, you were. Letting it flow in a major way last week.
Yeah. So look, I mean, the other one, if you're talking about managers imposing an obvious identity or style of play, I mean, okay, what about Brentford and Thomas Frank? I mean, this was really like, I mean, when was the last time you saw Liverpool look this rickety at the back? I was thinking, I'm not sure. I mean, Brentford's XG, I think, was 1.9. I thought that's quite high. I wonder how many times that happened to them. It's happened to Liverpool last season, which wasn't their best season. Well, it happened a few times. I mean, their worst performance in that respect was when they lost 7-2 to Aston Villa. Villa had something like 3.9 in the day. Man City beat them 4-1, and they had 3 point something. Leicester beat them 3-1, I think, and also had. But the fourth on the list was Midtjylland. I thought that was interesting. Remember, they played Midtjylland in the Champions League. And this was actually the game that they drew 1-1 over in Denmark. But the reason that that's interesting is because Midtjylland are like the Danish Brentford, or Brentford are the English Midtjylland. You know, it's the same ownership. It's the same template. And I guess against Liverpool, pretty much the same sort of game plan. A lot of long passes. I mean, Klopp was you know, complaining about this. So, Klopp did a strange thing in the game where it was 2-2 and he's going to make a substitute. And he's going to take off Curtis Jones and put on Firmino. And he just needs a stoppage in play to do this. And the stoppage in play arrives when Curtis Jones lashes the ball into the net to make it 3-2. And he then takes him off anyway and puts on Firmino. And I thought, are you still going to do that? Because that seems like a substitution you make at 2-2 rather than 3-2. You know, are you sure that's still the right play here? Given how chaotic this game has been, You know, do you now want to go 4-2-4 and just try, you know, it's three two, but now it's time to really open up and turn this into a slugfest. Let's start trading blows. Is that really what we want to do at this point? And Klopp was asked about this later, and he said, well, you know, I mean, I didn't think we, you know, he wasn't going to say. Well, I mean, he could have said, I made a mistake. I mean, it's not like he's never admitted to making a mistake before. But he did, he said something like, well, look, they only played long balls anyway. We didn't need another midfielder. Basically, there was nothing happening in midfield. They were just knocking it sort of back to front. But it just, I was, you know, I couldn't remember the last time I'd seen Liverpool look so vulnerable. I guess Villa, when they let in 7, that was Van Dijk, you know, pre-injury. He was involved in that game. They also had Adrian in goal in that game, of course. Alisson was in goal in this. Not that they could have had Adrian in goal. They could have had a traffic cone in goal for all the difference Alisson made, because I think all the shots by Brentford either went in or were cleared off the line by somebody who wasn't Alisson or hit the woodwork. You know what I mean? This is just what was happening. It wasn't his... Or, you know, there was the offside shot by Tony, which arrowed into the bottom corner with Alisson rooted to the spot. So... Yeah, I thought it was a little bit worrying from Liverpool's point of view to show what, like, direct play and two forwards, you know, much like, I guess, the Villa forwards, Watkins and Ings, the Brentford forwards were just sort of given license to really run and try and link up and make things happen. And yeah, Van Dijk and Matip had enormous problems. And obviously, I mean, they isolated Trent Alexander-Arnold. I mean, you know, you see three players attacking one at the back post, and you know this player's going to be in trouble. But Liverpool needed to sort that out, and I suppose Brentford showed a way that they, you know, the whole point of signing Van Dijk and the effect that he had was to stop. Actually, that was the game that it reminded me of. I don't know if you remember Liverpool drawing 3-3 with Watford on the first day of the 17-18 season. It was one of those chaos games where they have Mignolet's thrown one in. You know, Jurgen Klopp still hasn't sorted it out. Remember, we had Eamon Dunphy in, and he was saying Klopp can't organise a defence. It was around that time. It was based on games like this. He doesn't know what he's doing. He can't organise a defence. And actually, they signed Van Dijk, and suddenly it turned out he was able to head away all these situations. And it seemed like he wasn't able to do that against Brentford. And I don't know if that's just specific to Brentford or if it's a vulnerability that other teams might also expose.
On McDevitt!
All up in the interweb.
On McDevitt?
Worldwide.
The Murph and Mackey for Most Welcome Irishman of the Year goes to Owen McDevitt.
Owen McDevitt.
From Ireland's Second Captain Show.
All up in the interweb.
Owen McDevitt.
Worldwide.
Second Captains. Those guys are like family to me, man.
Owen McDevitt.
This is Locke. The coolest song I ever heard in my whole life.
Owen McDevitt.
All of you said I wouldn't make
it. Stop talking about Tom Finney.
He said I was a loser.
This guy is a bit of a turkey.
All right.
They said I was a fucking soccer. But look at me now. All up in the interweb.
Owen McDevitt.
Worldwide.
The new world veteran of the championship.
Owen McDevitt.
Owen McDevitt.
If you say, for example, the Barcelona team you worked at, is it fair to say anybody could have managed those guys?
No, of course not.
Rory Smith of the New York Times and Dion Fanning of The Currency are ready to talk about the weekend's football. Hi, guys.
Hey, Owen.
Hello.
How are things? We're going to start, I think, with the crushing win for Arsenal in the North London Derby. Really impressive stuff. The youngsters were on fire. Arteta had a real pep in his step for the first time in a while. Thierry Henry in the stands. Aubameyang doing an Henry-style goal celebration. Dion, the good times are back.
They are back. It was a vibrant Arsenal performance. And I do think that there probably is more to this Arsenal team than people felt after the opening three matches of the season. And I think they showed it yesterday in terms of what the young players, Smith Rowe, Saka, they were playing the perfect opponents as well. I think a kind of totally bedraggled Tottenham that didn't really know what to do. And once Arsenal scored, I think it did just inject the crowd, inject everybody with a sense of belief. And I think there are some signs of promise for Arsenal and very few right now for Tottenham.
Yeah, it is funny, Rory, when you're talking about this. I know Arsenal fans are, it's hard not to, they want their team to be praised and they deserve to be praised because they've had enough tricky times in recent years. But then it's also hard to do that without acknowledging how awful Tottenham were and whatever is going on there over the last couple of games. Maybe try and say something nice about Arsenal first.
It was as good as maybe as good a performance as Arteta's Arsenal have produced. I guess is that fair? That seems, I certainly can't think of another one. I'm going to resist the temptation to say that the number of games that you could count in that would be contenders is relatively small. The thing that strikes me with both of them is just how quickly the way they are seen has flipped around. So it's what, 3 weeks since we were thinking that Arteta was a dead man walking and was going to get sacked and it was going nowhere. And it was 3 weeks since Spurs were top of the lead, and we were saying, well, you know, Nuno's done a brilliant job here. You know, he's got them straight back, got them organised. It's the future. Could they challenge for the title? And I think the reality is for both of them, to be honest, is somewhere in between. That Arsenal are a work in progress. Spurs are, I think, trying to find out what their work in progress is going to look like. If you had to be one or the other, you'd probably want to be Arsenal. Not least as they won yesterday, but because they have the young players there that you look at and think, okay, there is the core of a team starting to coalesce there that won't challenge for the title this year or next year or probably the year after, but with the right signings, with a bit of luck and with a bit of kind of investment, you could see Arsenal starting to rebuild. Whereas with Spurs, you just feel as though they're treading water a little bit. So as much as Arsenal deserve to be delighted today, and as much as that euphoria is totally understandable, I think it should be, there has to be just a little bit of reality about it as well, that this isn't the dawn of, you know, Gerald Clichy saying that Arteta could be the new Wenger, and you think, well, they've won once against Tottenham, maybe we need to just calm down a little bit.
Yeah, I did feel though did you see Smith Rowe afterwards say, this is the best day of my life? Which I thought was quite a big statement, but you could sort of see how it is. Like, I mean, he's only kind of played in empty stadium football, you know, at this level. So this is kind of the first time he's experienced something like that. Just how great it can be, and it's something that Arteta's team has hardly experienced really since he's come in. And I feel as though that's been one of the big reasons why he's sort of struggled to build any momentum there until now.
Like, it did seem that one of the advantages, one of the first kind of joys of the crowds returning to stadiums was going to be watching Arsenal fans abuse their team at the start of the season. You know, that was like, this is what we were waiting for through all those long months. And you know, they got a bit of that obviously with the Chelsea defeat and at the start of the season. But yeah, there is, I think there is definitely a nice, as Rory says, there is a sweet spot between kind of embracing this as a starting point and thinking, you know, this is the best day of my life, but recognizing that it's only one win and not becoming kind of completely Roy Keane-ish on it, if you like. Because I saw people, you know, the pictures of the Arsenal dressing room last night and people alerting Roy Keane to this celebration. Like, the entire, it looked like everyone working for Arsenal had been brought into the dressing room to celebrate. And maybe that's a good thing considering where they were, but it is important that it's now understood as this is a starting point, rather than having beaten Spurs that you think that Arsenal think to see that they've kind of achieved something.
It's a problem with kind of how we think about football. It sounds like a really sort of poncy, pretentious, and fairly obvious thing to say, but it's just the volatility of the coverage is just extraordinary, and I really do genuinely believe it doesn't help anybody. It doesn't help the fans, it doesn't help the teams, it doesn't help everyone's general mental health. Like, for Arsenal to go from where they were, you know, people genuinely talking about, could Arsenal be relegated? No, Arsenal were never going to be relegated. To now it's kind of the dawn of this sort of age of Aquarius where Mikel Arteta's this genius. Like, the problems that led to the poor start still exist. There's still, like, no structure at Arsenal that makes any sense. There's no hierarchy at Arsenal that makes any sense. There's an issue over how much power Arteta has and whether there are checks and balances on that power. All that stuff is still legitimate. It doesn't detract from the victory yesterday. I think, to an extent, it's a failing in the media that we seem to have lost the ability to remember that kind of, there's another game next week and you have to win that game as well. And it's only after a span of 4, 5, 6 games that you can kind of get any real sense of whether, we won't know what this game means, what this win means, until the middle of November. It might mean nothing. It might be the start of Arsenal, you know, surging, and they might end up really building some momentum up, and by mid-November they may be in fifth, because it looks like that slot's open below the top four. But it might not be, because they are still a work in progress. And I think that our failure to reflect that is a little bit of a betrayal's a bit strong, but it doesn't really leave fans with much chance, to be perfectly honest. And that's something that we have to address.
Yeah, I know. I do hear this being said, Rory, but at the same time, coverage is going to be pretty bland if everybody's just constantly on an even keel about things and overreacting. I do TV stuff over here, and we actually didn't have time for post-match analysis, but we were doing Leeds at West Ham at the weekend. If we were doing a post-match, of course I would have had to have been driving the, geez, is Bielsa, you know, having a complete crisis here, even though maybe that's unfair on him, because that's, otherwise what do you do, you know? What do you talk about if you're not getting a bit stuck in?
But you see, I think the Leeds one is changing the subject. I think the Leeds one's kind of fair enough now, that it does look like Leeds have got a bit of a problem. It's the immediate switch from Arsenal are going to be relegated to can Arsenal challenge for the top four within the space of a fortnight, and that just leaves me a little bit cold.
What do you reckon, Dion?
Yeah, as somebody
on the general point that
I know
it's too reactionary, which is true, by the way. I mean, I don't disagree with that point. I just wonder, is that the way it has to be now to keep everyone interested?
This is how we live today, you know, and. And I take Rory's point. I think it's a point about judgment as much as anything, in terms of there is a need to be seen. There is a need to make kind of definitive statements and sweeping judgments all the time, and to call things, you know, to call things, and you know. I found myself thinking this about Arsenal earlier in the season, that I thought they had quite a good young team. But like this morning, I was finally annoyed at myself. I have no record of this in the public arena at all. I have no, you know, I was like, why haven't I put this out?
I didn't place a bet.
You know,
I didn't. It's gambling. This is it's basically gambling without money. This is
yeah.
What we're,
and
this
I was
what
like, you know, is there a what? Do I have a WhatsApp? Do I have anything?
but the best example of it is Chelsea. So Chelsea, you have. I mean, I did a piece last week about the genius of Thomas Tuchel, and all of that stuff is true. They're European champions. You can't take away anything Chelsea have achieved. But there has definitely been, over the course of the last month, a failure to remember that Manchester City exist, and it has become just a truism that Chelsea had done a walk to the title, that Chelsea are the best equipped. And you look at City and you think, well, hang on, they won the title really easily last year and they've added a £100 million player. Now, whether he's the right £100 million player or not is a different, quite valid debate. But, you know, City are stronger than they were last season and were last season infinitely stronger than everybody else. Our ability to forget that Manchester City are should throughout this process have been the kind of the standard answer, like outright favourites for the title, is really odd. And it's just like, I'm not saying Chelsea aren't a great team, they are, and they will run City close, but it shouldn't have been that it felt like Saturday was like the day that Chelsea would assert their dominance over City. Chelsea is still the insurgent in that dynamic.
Yeah, they have been the favourites though, Rory. I mean, City, you know, if you actually look at the actual gambling market, the one that involves money rather than just bullshit, they have been the favorites all along. You know, they can't, but like, no one wants to bet on an odds-on favorite to win the league. I mean, what's the point? Your money is tied up all season. Whereas if you kind of are predicting Chelsea, I mean, and in fairness, Chelsea did beat them in the Champions League final, on a number of, like, they beat them 3 times in a row, I guess, under Tuchel. So I think there was, and you could say, well, their signings, maybe their big signing looked as though it would strengthen them more than City's signing strengthened them. So I can sort of understand it. Do you mean to say, though, that based on what we saw on Saturday, that City have completely reasserted their authority? They've sort of reminded everybody, well, I mean, you know, actually, with City in the league, who else really has a chance?
I think, like, Owen's point is really, really valid, that if you just say, well, the team that's obviously the best is going to win the lead, it gets pretty boring after a while. So I don't understand why there is a desire to see if there's a Chelsea or a Liverpool or a Man United or whatever who can challenge them. I think it will be close, because Chelsea and City are both excellent teams. But I think it was a little reminder that City are probably a more finished article than Chelsea are at this point. That Chelsea are not, although they've had a brilliant start to the season, they are still the coming team. That they are trying to close the gap. City are the established power. It was just a little reminder of where the actual kind of where everybody sits just a little bit. It doesn't decide the title.
I wasn't sure that City had a performance like that in them, though. You know, I mean, because on the basis, I suppose, if they did, where was it when they needed it in the Champions League final? I haven't seen City play that well in a really long time, and I was pretty impressed that they could still do it.
I think there are good reasons for why people said what they said about Chelsea. And I take Rory's point completely that the advantages Manchester City have, where they're coming from, where they're starting from, mean that you can't, like, to be saying they're done seems excessive. But at sometimes you do look at, and I think people look at a manager like Pep, and they look at his methods, and they, you know, it is legitimate and understandable if you say, okay, there is a trend here, and there is a possibility of a decline and of diminishing returns on what you get from Pep. And the season, you know, the Champions League final being a great example, the season so far being there being moments of that as well. You know, the opening league game of the season, the game against Spurs, you know, like there's lots of examples where you can say, right, and what Tuchel has done does seem so impressive. Now, I think in some ways, I think on Saturday there was almost an example of what he does. I got a sense watching Chelsea in the first half, they're waiting for him to kind of do something. They're waiting, like, to have the same corrective that they had against Spurs. They're sort of sitting here waiting for something. They just think we can just play in this sort of holding pattern until we change it, and it kind of caught them out. But I do think there are I still think, you know, there are reasons to be not as confident about Manchester City. Put it this way, not as confident as Manchester City as you should be, given where they finished last season and that they have spent 100 million on a player.
Well, we've been talking about this sort of amnesiac crisis to disaster to triumph sort of cycle that we're all trapped in. But when is it time to stop giving a manager time? Does the time ever happen, Rory? Do we? I mean, who do you think I'm going to ask you about?
are you going to ask about Jurgen Klopp, who disgracefully dropped 2 points to another team? Is that this is a Solskjaer question, isn't it? Bi-weekly is Ole Gunnar Solskjaer good enough for Manchester United?
Yeah.
To which we all know the answer is no. Like, we all know that it's blindingly obvious. He seems like a nice fella, and he's a decent kind of sub Zidane. Keep everybody happy, talk up the club. Their basic talent level is so high.
I put it to you, Rory, that they, you know, I've seen people saying surely time's up, 3 defeats in 4. I would say the good times are only beginning. They've got 13 points from 18. It's the same as Thomas Tuchel.
It's the same as Thomas Tuchel, except that you have to wait it for who they've played.
Well, they've played young boys, West Ham, Aston Villa. These are good underrated teams. They've got great players who are ready to dovetail a new attack that's come together, a team that's ready to explode, and a patient and far-sighted manager who understands some of the things that we've been talking about here today.
Is that a quote from somebody?
No, this is a quote from me.
From Ken. Well, it's a quote from Ken Early.
It's right. He's ready to oversee this. Look, you know, we've had sort of emails on this point. You know, people saying, "Look, what's the problem?" United fans saying, "What is the problem? Why is everybody trying to sack Ole for us the whole time? Can't they see that he's doing a good job? Can't they see that after everything this club has been through, this guy is taking us the right direction? It's slow and steady. You're not going to win every week, but we're going to get there."
To me, there's nothing new to be said on this, but to me, Solskjaer will go down in history as the most likely, depending on on kind of whether United have a brain or not, like in terms of their infrastructure. Solskjaer will go down. He has secured his place in history as the United manager who restored a bit of stability. That's definitely true. He's done a really good job from that point of view. He's made the club feel whole again, to quote Atomic Kitten. He's kind of got the, you know, there's not that kind of split between the fans and there's not a kind of manager who's constantly starting fires. It doesn't feel like they're trapped in a cycle where they are trapped in the cycle of boom and bust, but they're not trapped in the cycle of like hire and fire. Solskjaer's done a lot to kind of restore equanimity to Manchester United, and that's really important, and he's done a good job with that. To me, the basic issue is that United have so many good players that they will, through individual talent alone, probably get 75 points a season. That's how many points Manchester United squad can probably get by themselves with a kind of Steve McLaren figure in charge. You know, just a decent coach who organises them, make sure that there's a training session organised every day, kind of has enough cones, that sort of thing. That kind of manager will get you to 75, 76 points with United. What the Manchester United manager's job is to make sure that you get the extra 14 points that turns you into title contenders. Whether Solskjaer can do that, I don't know. Although the one bit of mitigating circumstance is that squad is full of individual talent and makes absolutely zero sense. And that is partly his fault, but it's not exclusively his fault. And that was always going to be the issue with United. And it doesn't look like he has managed to find order in the chaos of the Man United squad just yet.
Well, he won the mind games, Dion, with officialdom during the week, given out about not getting enough penalties. Then he gets a penalty. Then, interestingly, Bruno takes it. I don't know I'm sure I wasn't the only one who just assumed that Ronaldo, even though it made no sense, seeing as Bruno scores all his penalties, I just assumed Ronaldo would be taking that. But I couldn't fail to be drawn to Ronaldo skulking around the bottom of the screen as Bruno. Now, by the time I saw Bruno miss his penalty, I knew what was about to happen because it was later on in the day. But it was such a dramatic moment. And poor old Solskjaer, he can't really legislate for his ace penalty taker blasting at 15 yards over the bar.
Well, no, but I suppose he couldn't legislate for David Moyes sending Mark Noble on the week before either to take a penalty. Mm. So that kind of got United out of jail. I think on the broader point, I do think this is an interesting experiment. What Manchester, you know, basically Manchester United experimenting with, you know, how far can you go with a manager who really isn't capable of doing the things, as Rory says, that a top class manager can do. And you know, there's a lot of evidence that says that, you know, a manager is an important factor, but is not the key factor in terms of success of a modern football club. And Manchester United seem to be intent on demonstrating that, you know, that they don't really need a top class manager to succeed. And the other factor, as Rory touched on, is that you know, the imbalance in the side. Like, do Manchester United as a club want a manager who will say, I don't want Ronaldo, I want Declan Rice or whoever, or a Declan Rice, I figure, I don't want you, I don't, get you know, stand Rio Ferdinand down, tell Alex Ferguson that it's okay, I don't want Ronaldo. Like, is that, do they want that manager? Because, or do they want the kind of Manchester United, and it's become a cliche they say, but the Manchester United theme park, you know, the whole experience, Ole's at the wheel, Rio's pulling some strings, Alex Ferguson's in the background, and Ole is in the room, but he's kind of sitting over in the corner waiting for someone to look at him, and nobody does. And that seems to be what Manchester United, as currently constituted, wants to be. And so a manager like Solskjaer seems to sort of suit that structure. But with that, I think, and I don't think that's sustainable. If results are bad, if results are, you know, and if, you know, things don't improve, then that isn't sustainable. But that does, he does seem to serve a purpose in the Manchester United post Alex Ferguson.
Yeah, I do wonder though sometimes if we are too hard on this guy. You know, when you look at, for instance, the plaudits heaped on somebody like Marcelo Bielsa, you mentioned already, Rory, former or FIFA Coach of the Year nominee last season. I think himself, Jurgen Klopp, and Hansi Flick were the three names nominated for the best coach in the world. and no wins so far. Now, I mean, I saw Mikel Antonio and David Moyes saying some stuff about, they said the kind of things that are quite unusual to hear a team say about its opposition. Mikel Antonio said, oh, I feel like I've run a marathon. Moyes was saying, oh, it was like basketball. I mean, I watched the game and it was a crazy end-to-end game. Leeds were definitely a bit unlucky, but the pattern or the general tendency here is bad. Is there a case that Marcelo Bielsa has been massively overrated? Like, this is a guy who is able to tell his players to run around and get them to do that in a way that not a lot of coaches seem to be able to do. But at the expense of essentially not having a defense and just conceding goals willy-nilly all the time and ultimately presiding over a ridiculous football entity.
I think that there's a valid point concealed within a slight overreach in that point of view, which I'm not saying is yours. I think Bielsa has not been overrated in terms of what he's achieved either at Leeds or in his career in general. But there is a cost to what he does, which is his belief is that if you play that kind of basketball style, that end-to-end frenetic style, that over the course of a season that you'll win more than you lose, that you'll score more than you concede, and that it's worth doing it. He also, I think, has a sort of aesthetic reason behind it too. The issue with Leeds now is I hate the idea that teams get worked out, because it makes it sound like the first time West Ham will ever have seen Leeds play was when they met them in the Premier League last season. And David Moyes would have been like, oh, who's this Argentinian guy who's in charge? And that's funny, isn't it? They run around a lot, this team. That's really unusual. Like they all know what everyone else is doing. And I can believe just about that seeing it up close and personal, getting used to it for the first time, is a bit of a culture shock when you face any new team. But I would have thought the professional footballers within about half an hour have managed to think, right, these are obviously the kind of terms of engagement, so I now know what I have to do, and they're either up to it or they're not. Certainly by this stage, I don't think that there would be any surprise that teams know how to deal with Leeds and know what they have to do to cope with Leeds. I think the issue is that those fine margin victories that Leeds were getting last year, they haven't had in the first six games of the season. There will be a kind of... The instinctive thing as a fan is to say, right, well, you need to shut up shop, you need to, you know, close everything up, make everything tight at the back, don't lose a couple of games and sort of rebuild your confidence. That's how you think as a fan. That's not how Bielsa will see it at all. But I do think there's a possibility. I'm pretty sure there's three teams that are worse than Leeds, and I don't think Leeds will get relegated. But I do think they'll find points much harder to come by this season than last season, just because it feels as though, the things that worked in their favour last year have been neutralised a little bit by everybody else.
Yeah, and I kind of thought after the loss was a 5-1 to United on the opening day, it wasn't even particularly remarked upon because they'd been beaten heavily by the same opponents the previous year, and there's kind of a sense that that's the risk you take, and the players are aware of that as well, that this is the risk of playing in a Marcelo Bielsa team. You're going to get spanked like that the odd time. But surely, even psychologically, like any other team, this start of the season is going to start affecting them and their belief in what they're doing, or is that a little bit unfair considering they were so good last year? And in fairness, they've got a lot of injuries at the moment too.
Yeah, I think, again, it goes back to what we started talking about, the sort of the grander statements that we feel obliged to make after a certain performance or even after five or six games. And I think Leeds are probably entering into that stage, especially after Saturday, where they start, there might be a bit more anxiety creeping in, a bit more anxiety creeping in to the supporters. And again, that is a factor this year. Now, I know Leeds supporters and Bielsa, there's going to take a lot for them to kind of to question it. But the natural anxieties that are transmitted in a stadium to have a way of kind of getting out there, and if Bielsa isn't going to change, so Bielsa isn't going to do the things that Sam Allardyce would do or whoever to get the result, and that's correct really, but it still also does create its own pressure if things don't go right quickly. But I do feel, I think Leeds are probably going to be in more of a I'm of a relegation struggle this season, but I seem to think they'll stay up. And I think from where they've come from, again, that is the thing that is only the only thing really that matters for these. Like it's interesting. I think it was in that Gary Neville interview with Roy Keane that he said that about Sunderland. Now, obviously, totally different manager, but when he was, you know, his first season at Sunderland, Sunderland did quite well. And Keane said the big mistake he made in his second season was thinking, oh, we're going for top eight or we're going for top 10 or whatever. And Sunderland spent a lot of money that summer. And he said, you know, the reality was we were fighting to stay up that season too. And you're fighting to stay up for a long time as a club that goes into the Premier League. And that's the truth about Leeds, no matter who the manager is. And it isn't a question of being found out or isn't a question of... you know, being Bielsa being overpraised, but that is just the reality for any club. Even if they spend a bit of money, and they're not spending frightening amount of money, but even if they spend a bit of money, that is the reality, and especially as they are at the moment when they're struggling with some injuries.
A dogmatic manager committed to playing attractive football, whatever the circumstances. Where have we had that conversation before recently, Dion? Listen, we'll leave it there. Great stuff, Dion. Rory, brilliant stuff. Thank you.
Thanks, cheers, guys.
Just a crying big baby.
But you cannot call a player a baby. Touch!
Touch!
Touch! This is the game you wanted a victory, but it didn't happen. What happened?
I want victory for every game.
Where do you think you got it all wrong today?
Touch! This is the game you wanted a victory, but it didn't happen. What happened?
Well, it's just the nervousness.
You look frustrated on the pitch.
This is the game you wanted a victory, but it didn't happen. What happened?
You wanted victory.
Well, I wanted victory.
Touch! This is the game you wanted a victory, but it didn't happen. What happened?
Where do you think you got it all wrong today?
Won against them in the Premiership, and we never said they are baby.
He's just a crying big baby.
And you cannot call a player a baby.
I'm sure our Liverpool fans listening will be intrigued by the nature of that conversation. Will it be Man City or will it be Chelsea who win the league? Considering I'm looking at the top of the table now, and it appears to be, despite their wobble against Brentford, it appears to be Liverpool on 14 points, top of the table. So are we ruling them out a little bit early?
Well, not until next Sunday when they play Man City, and you know, that's going to be obviously a big game. I mean, City have just, last week on certain podcasts, we're kind of, City, I wonder now, I wonder. And they go to Chelsea, shut them down. Chelsea didn't have a shot on target. Didn't have a shot off target either, I think. Maybe, you know, if we don't count the block shots, apparently. Just shots that are either go on target and are saved by the keeper or go wide are apparently counted. It seems a bit strange to me, but they, you know, just when we were talking to Rory there about, Rory and Dion about what City did, I mean, what really impressed me was just how they kind of went after Chelsea and like intimidated them into these mistakes. I mean, Tuchel was afterwards saying, oh, you know, I didn't feel like we believed we could escape with, you know, if you I'd love to be able to watch that game back with the original BT Sports commentary in the company of Thomas Tuchel, just to hear what he would have to say about everything Steve McManaman was saying. Because I swear after 2 minutes, McManaman was screaming that Chelsea had to start going long to Lukaku. Like it was 2 minutes of the game had happened. He's like, oh, what are they doing? We all like our teams to play nice, entertaining, attractive football, but sometimes you just got to go long
get
to
it
the
lunch.
Big man.
Just get it lunch, Tubby.
And in the game, the Chelsea eventually did do that in a panicked clearance, became their best chance. Like Werner got it and sort of crossed to Lukaku, who nearly scored. And that was basically, it turned out also their best chance of the game. Like what City did was like, whoa, I honestly didn't think City could still do this. Like I wasn't sure that they still were capable of producing a performance that commanding. And well, they were. And now they've got to do it against PSG tomorrow, and then it's Anfield on Sunday. And if they win all those games, then you're looking at going, hang on, is everyone already playing for second place already? Is that the situation we're in? So that could be
where we are. Put it this way, if they win again at Anfield next weekend, on the, then this day week, we will anoint them as champions elect.
I love it. After the conversation about getting a little bit too carried away by individual results, we're going to wrap the show there. Champions League coming up this week, including Paris Saint-Germain against possible Premier League champions elect Man City. That game is on tomorrow, and the other matches that I mentioned earlier on. We'll be covering all that on the World Service, so you're going to have to be a member to hear that stuff. Thanks, Ken. Thanks, Murph.
Thank you.
Thank you, Owen. Thank you, Ken. Karen.
That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home, those boys. It is not war and death and famine. It's not that at all. It's the opposite of that. It's the persuasion of the world outside of that. That's why sport's important.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up Quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's Quince.com/upgrade.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.